problems that there are in the punitive damages regime, that, that all is not well in the land of punitive damages. But you also see the court's answer to the raising of these policy concerns, which is, in effect, go someplace else. We're going to apply punitive damages on a case-by-case basis without regard to suggestions that doing so comes at the cost of other important social values. That may be, in effect, says the court, but it's an issue that has to be resolved by the legislatures. We can't fix the system ourselves. What I want to spend time on today is making sure we understand kind of the mechanics of how these kinds of awards are made. The first thing we talked about yesterday was what standard to use. And again, that's the most important question. As you look at a fact pattern, you want to get a preliminary read on whether this is the kind of case that would generate not just a compensatory, a potential for a compensatory award, but the potential for a punitive damage award. And a punitive damage award typically shows up in those cases where there's a calculated decision to forego some safety measure because of the desire to save money or some other sort of selfish interest, and the interest of innocent people and the public is put on the back burner. Now, again, that's a pretty vague description, and it could include such things as you're setting the cruise control on your car to 75 when the speed limit is 65. But I don't think you would consider that to be worthy of a punitive damage award if you got into an accident. So, again, there's a kind of je ne sais quoi about what it is that makes this dividing line. And all I can do is sort of suggest that as a plaintiff's advocate, you want to consider whether it's in the ballpark. As an advocate for a defendant, you want to anticipate the potential of where you think it's there. Just as an example of this application, several years ago I was rummaging through Westlaw to find a suitable case to use for an exam, and I came across a case involving a guy who at 2 o'clock in the morning got hungry and lived in a downtown area and left his apartment, went across a parking lot for a fast food joint in search of some place that was still open, couldn't find any place that was still open, saw the dumpster, and thought there might be some food there that had been thrown out that was perfectly good food. As he tried to enter the dumpster, the retaining wall that he was trying to climb up on collapsed on him, and the reason it collapsed was because earlier it had been struck by a dump truck backing up to pick up the dumpster, and somebody miscalculated and damaged this retaining wall. The employees had complained to their supervisor, you know, that this thing was unstable. And the supervisor said, essentially, shut up and get back to work. Now, this guy, when the retaining wall collapsed on him, it was very serious. He lost a leg as a consequence. And he sued. And there were lots of other issues in the case. such as what his status was, whether he's a trespasser, all this kind of stuff. But one of the issues would be the likelihood if you were, I think it was a Burger King or a Hardee's or somebody where this accident happened. If you're Burger King getting sued by this guy because you failed to deal with this dangerous condition, I think there's a liability for punitive damages there. As it turns out, the court allowed a punitive damages instruction to go to the jury, and the jury awarded this guy, as I recall, $600,000. Now, I would not have bet the farm on this guy's potential for a large recovery, but again, one of the things you want to do is kind of look at it from the standpoint, well, you know, after all, they did knowingly expose people to this hazard. There had been complaints by their own employees, so forth and so on. Now, if you said, well, they might argue for punitive damages, but I can't feature a jury making an award for a dumpster diver to the extent, you know, I wouldn't be terribly worried about that. That's an acceptable answer, although it turns out to be wrong. You've at least identified the issue and rolled it around and said, in effect, to your client, here's the issue. It depends on what a jury thinks. Your guess is as good as mine as to whether a jury, and as we know more about the facts, just what was the exchange between the employees and the employer? What did the employer say? How likely is it that a jury would have some kind of moral outrage over the employer's, the Burger King's decision to leave this condition as it was? And from what you get on an exam set of facts, you typically don't get very much from which you can make an intelligent assessment of the likelihood that there's going to be punitive damage exposure. But again, that's what you're working with, and you want to at least consider that possibility if in fact there's a risk there. So, again, the most important thing we've been looking at is where is this dividing line? But beyond that, we have a bunch of other issues. One issue is what kinds of employees' conduct gives rise to punitive damage exposure. If, for example, you run a stock brokerage company, and a couple of your employees decide they're going to make a little extra money by engaging in a check kiting scheme. That happened at E.F. Hutton, as I recall, or one of the big brokerage houses. Is that something for which the company is liable, or do you say, oh, these rogue employees, we didn't know what they were up to? Their actions can't fairly be attributed to the corporation. So that's one of the issues that we look at in Grimshaw, which is on page 24, is the question of the scope of liability for a corporation. Schmidt? Well, you've made a good argument as to why the plaintiff's claim has some traction to it. And again, it's very difficult sitting in your armchair as a lawyer to imagine what is going to be the composition of the jury, exactly what will the testimony, once it's fleshed out, look like, how sympathetic will this character be, you know, does he have a previous conviction for armed robbery that's going to be a problem? I mean, in one sense, that's not relevant, but, well, yeah, that's probably going to affect the way the jury looks at this. You know, what does the manager look like? What is the testimony about what the manager said? And as I've said before, one of the difficulties in doing this kind of analysis is to, in effect, take me out of the equation. I think I know what I think about that situation, whether I have moral outrage over it, but that's not really the question before the House. The question before the House is, what's this jury going to think? What is the likelihood that my impulse as to what to do with this case is going to be shared by the jury? Is my impulse as to what to do with this case a reliable reflection of what the jury will do, or should I pull back for a moment and say, well, I know this is what I think, but there are a lot of people out there who would look at this quite differently. So again, perhaps for some people, it makes all the difference in the world that this didn't happen to one of those, you know, high school students who's flipping burgers to earn a little extra cash. It happened to a guy who should have known better, who really had no business being there. But then again, it may not make any difference to those people. They may say what the employer did could just as easily have happened to one of their own employees, and I want to smack these people upside the head. And depending on which of those two impulses the jury is motivated by, it's going to have a very different outcome. And again, my purpose here is to say, sort of think globally, act locally, think more inclusively before you reach a conclusion to say, oh, it's going to be like this. It might, then again, it might not. And you would rather advise your client in a way that holds open more possibilities, many of which never occur, than to so precisely predict the outcome that you run the risk of not including one or more factors that turns out to be very important, and you haven't even talked about them. That's a place I don't want you to be. So, again, just this first issue of calibrating your sense of what's likely to be on the table, that's the important question. All right, now, Grimshaw. Breck? And burst into flame. Yeah, right. Okay. And burn injuries tend to be extremely painful, extremely disfiguring. They're like spinal cord injuries. Burn injuries tend to generate very large damage awards. Okay. Is the other way around? We've got, I think it's Richard, actually, again, the living victim who's got the serious burn injuries. That's in part why the recovery is so high, whereas Mrs. Grimshaw, the wrongful death case, is worth only $550,000. It's something that we'll see later on. You've probably encountered this before, that it's cheaper to kill somebody than it is to maim them. And whether that makes any sense or not, again, is something we'll talk about in the wrongful death section. Okay, but here we are. These are the awards, and this is the judgment that was entered. What verdict did the jury return? Right. This is the principle of what's called remittiture. You essentially say to the winning party, typically the plaintiff, you remit, forego, all but $3.5 million of your punitive damage award, and I will deny the motion for a new trial. If you don't do that, however, if you insist on the full $125 million, then I will order a new trial and let the appeals court deal with it at that point. And so the plaintiff says, no, I'm not going to remit it. I want to appeal this holding a gun to my head. I don't think that's right. I think I'm entitled to the full $125 million. And the defendant similarly says, we shouldn't have to pay any of this. No punitive award. Why not? And to that extent, it's exactly the same issue as Edward Moran. Yeah. Again, nobody at Ford sat around saying, how can we get these stupid people to drive Pintos? There's no actual malice, far from it. I mean, Ford would love to not have any of these cases happen. It's bad in all sorts of ways. But what does the court say in response to the argument that the plaintiff hasn't established enough in terms of culpability? Right. Again, this is a conscious disregard of the risk of injury. Not just the risk of injury, the virtual certainty that some people are going to get killed. Now, again, it's in some ways hard to distinguish this from the other design considerations in making an automobile, as we talked about in connection with the learned hand formula. You make an automobile, you make an airplane, you're making design choices all the time that enhance or reduce the likelihood of carnage as to this particular aspect. What about side impact airbags or support beams? you know, the weight of the vehicle, the placement of the gas tank, and so forth. All of these things affect whether you're going from this likelihood to that likelihood of injury. And at some level, you know that some people are going to die in your vehicle. Does that convert every one of these design choices, if it turns out to be mistaken, into something that not only merits compensation to the plaintiff, but permits the jury to make a punitive award to teach these people a lesson? Well, there is something kind of egregious about the Pinto case. Again, it's a je ne sais quoi. This one stinks a whole lot worse than the average design choice. Maybe it's this $10 thing. The fact that it's $400 to put in whatever, you know, side pillars or side airbags, as distinguished from $10 to put some liner in the gas tank. Maybe it's the horror of the burn death and the burn injury. Something about this gets the jury's moral outrage in motion. The fact that they ran the equation. Maybe that's the, again, learned hand might suggest this is what reasonable people do, but the jury will have none of it. Again, we're sort of conflicted at this point, but the court says, in effect, to the extent that we're looking for flagrant, reckless disregard, this seems to be it. No error in giving it to the jury on the basis of punitive damages. What are Ford's other arguments? Okay. Right. Yeah, the engineers are proposing solutions to this. The engineers, they're not looking at spreadsheets and cost factors. Engineers want to build a better car, and it's management that essentially says no to engineering at this juncture. So there's a very clear paper trail here. Although this idea of the 72 and 73 standards, think about what we're looking at here. Congress delayed the implementation of these standards. Congress could have imposed these standards sooner, but they delayed until a later date these minimum standards for survivability. Why isn't there moral outrage against Congress? And again, Ford looks at this. Of course, Ford is quite happy that their clout in Washington is such that they can get Congress to delay these things. And now that sort of comes home to roost. But to some extent, the auto industry might say it's a mixed blessing when we get through to Congress and get them to delay these things and lower the standards, because that's not the law the jury will apply. If the jury's morally outraged, the fact that we, you know, persuaded Congress to postpone this for a couple of years won't do us any good. It'll simply lead us down the primrose path. But again, the industry would say, I thought this was a political process in which the people decided what kind of rules they want, but apparently not. It's the if the trial lawyer can corral 12 jurors and whip them up into a frenzy, they'll fry us like a pancake. Sort of like the people in the back of the Pinto, actually. But again, it's, you know, this kind of conflicting world of it's not a seamless, you know, coherent picture. It's this kaleidoscope of conflicting and competing demands. Okay, But the court says jury was perfectly justified in holding Ford responsible for this because the paper trail of high management. Now again, this is either, as the statute points out, either somebody with managerial authority or a subsequent ratification. So let's distinguish in the Ford case some grumpy guy on the assembly line who's bitter about how Ford has treated him, and he starts pulling brake lines off the cars as they roll off the assembly line, and these cars are sold to people and they drive them off the lot and they smash into a tree. Deliberately sabotaged braking system. Is Ford responsible for that? No, not for some rogue guy on the assembly line who pulls these things off. Even a small group of, there are a bunch of cars with significant safety problems and there's a guy on a production schedule and his normal protocol would be to go back and fix all these things, but he's worried that he's going to show up on a bad report and says, put the covers on them and get them out of here. Even, three or four people at that level doing this kind of thing, knowing about it, won't trigger punitive damage liability for the corporation. It will. They're still in the course and scope of employment. They're still negligent. There's still compensatory liability, but there's no liability for punitive damages unless it's the act of the corporation that is flagrantly indifferent to safety or to the value of human life. But when people with managerial authority, like Lee Iacocca and the other people in Ford's management, that says, so what if the fuel tanks aren't as good as they could be? We're behind schedule, get them out the door. Alternatively, even if it's done by those low-level people, and then this is revealed to someone in managerial authority. So one of the guys who's part of this conspiracy to just put the covers back on this thing and get them out the door, he blabs to someone else to say, hey, my supervisor, I complained that we weren't done with these things, and my supervisor said, just put the cover on them and get them out of here. That's revealed to management after it's gone, and management does nothing. Ratification can also get you in trouble, even though the initial bad act was not done by somebody with managerial authority. But again, in the Pinto case, that applies without any difficulty. Okay, what about the calculate? Go ahead. Essentially, by persons with managerial authority. Yeah. So either the initial decision is made by somebody with managerial authority, or later it's ratified by somebody with managerial authority. Yeah. Well, it's a similar kind of analysis. That is, can we properly attribute this act to the corporation? But it's a little bit different. For purposes of compensatory liability, I only need to show that this person was acting in the course and scope of employment. So a low-level employee who forgets to put the bolts back on the, whatever it is before the thing is shipped and the safety device falls off, that's enough for vicarious liability. For punitive damages liability, it's not enough until the act that generates punitive damage award is sufficiently far up the chain of command that we can say this was done by someone with managerial authority. A low-level employee who does something really despicable can trigger compensatory liability, but not punitive damages liability. Okay. So now, with respect to the calculation of the award, how do we calculate the size of the punitive damage award? How do we know $125 million is too much? How do we know that $3.5 million is enough? Well, I want to leave the issues about the constitutional limitations to that case, but just in terms of the mechanics, what do you take into account? In other words, BMW talks about a supervisory court setting limits to how far is too far, but here the first question is how do we even go about deciding what the award is in the first place? What do we take into account? Right? Our degree of moral outrage, how culpable the conduct is, severity of the injury, the underlying compensatory award. What else do we take into account in the punitive damage award that we don't take into account in a compensatory award? What's fair game for the plaintiff to point to? I'm sorry, Mr. Green? Yeah, how rich the defendant is. If I'm involved in an intersection collision and I'm the defendant, the plaintiff can't argue to the jury as a reason for me to be held liable that I've got plenty of dough. And I can't argue by way of mitigation, I'm just a poor, you know, struggling college professor here. It's irrelevant. I'm either, you know, liable because I acted negligently or I'm subject to strict liability or I'm not. But when we come to a punitive damage award, the defendant's net worth, capacity to pay, is relevant on the theory that to get my attention, the award has to hurt. So if I'm a really, really rich guy, a really, really rich corporation, it may take a larger award to get my attention than if, you know, I'm a smaller entity and even a small award will hurt. So what does this award represent relative to Ford's overall net worth? 0.0 something or other. It's a very small, $3.5 million is a lot of money to you and me, but it's not a lot of money to Ford. And the plaintiff thinks they should have gotten the $125 million, but the trial judge thought, perhaps, we don't really get the benefit of the thinking of the trial judge in why the award was reduced to $3.5 million, but it may be that when you think about the other victims of the Pinto collisions, by the time Ford gets done paying the other people who are going to line up the cashier's window and say, where's my punitive damage award, that Ford will wind up in the sum total of these cases paying a very significant amount, and they will certainly get the message. Now, again, whether or not the trial judge should take this into account, as we talked about in Moran, the firstest with the mostest versus some kind of, you know, allocation of the award spread out amongst the different beneficiaries. We don't really have a rule for that, but I'm just guessing that the trial judge was thinking about that when the award was reduced from 125 to $3.5 million. Okay, in the minutes we have remaining today, I'd like to just briefly cover this BMW Inc. versus Gore. And make sure we get the bottom line here, which is pretty simple, even though the discussion is quite complex. Mr. Phillips? Pinto? Yeah. This is essentially the remittiture. In other words, what the trial judge says, I'm granting the motion for a new trial, but I'll back off of that if the plaintiff foregoes all but $3.5 million. So the question is whether the trial judge has that authority, and the court says yes, the trial judge does. Again, we don't get the court doesn't explain to us why they cut, in effect, allowed the trial judge to cut it down from 125 to $3.5 million. Right. Yeah. So, because they affirm that the remittiture without really explaining why. They, as you say, they justify why it's a punitive damage award at all, and that we're nodding our heads to. What the court doesn't explain is, well, if all this stuff is true, why are you affirming the trial judges? One of the reasons I might point out is that in reviewing a trial judge's grant of a motion for a new trial, including a motion for remittiture, appellate courts exercise deference toward the trial judge because the trial judge heard the witnesses, had the benefit of being there at the trial. And if the trial judge says, in effect, this is too much, the appellate court doesn't say, in effect, you can only do that essentially on a cold record if we are all persuaded of the same thing. We may not see why this is too much. But if the trial judge, looking at it, says it's too much, so long as it's not an abuse of his or her discretion, we let that stand. Yeah. Yes.
Cost of 11 million cars and 1.5 million trucks, like trucks, $11 for inflation. So, how much ever came up? Somebody asked, why didn't you just do it on the Pinto, not all of your cars? And that would have been a lot less.
I think my summary here may be a little bit truncated here as to. I'm pretty sure these were apples to apples, that they weren't comparing apples to oranges, and maybe in summarizing they didn't quite make that clear. But that would certainly be. But I'm also quite confident that Ford would have pointed that out if it were true, that you're not comparing. When we did this thing, we were comparing apples to apples, and if the thing looked better for them, or for that matter for the plaintiff, if it looked worse. That would have been clarified. So, again, my question there is, going back to the learned hand calculus, is it a mistake to think that when you run these numbers, you've accurately judged the reasonableness of the safety measure? And the jury says, in effect, what were you thinking? And the engineers, as we've talked about before, essentially say, well, that's what learned hand. That's how I learned to think from learned hand. Maybe I learned to think like a lawyer. And it was therein where I made my mistake. Okay, now let's talk for a moment about BMW Inc. versus Gore. One of the sort of underlying stories here is the whole question of whether the United States Supreme Court, using its authority from the U.S. Constitution, should be reviewing punitive damage awards for a violation of due process. And for a long time, they took a long time getting there. And Scalia and others on the court were very critical of the idea that this was the Supreme Court's business. And by contrast, in BMW Inc. versus Gore, a majority of the court said, yes, it is our business. We have an obligation to review these things to make sure they're not excessive. And so the question is, okay, how do you know when something is excessive? And the court in BMW Inc. versus Gore said, as is summarized on page 32 in the right-hand column, you compare the degree of reprehensibility, another word for that might be the culpability of the defendant's conduct, the ratio, the comparison between the compensatory award and the punitive award, and and you look at what comparable sanctions are imposed for this kind of conduct in civil or criminal law. So one of the reasons, the facts of BMW Inc. versus Gore, quite simply, were Dr. Gore bought this BMW, drove it around for a while, decided he wanted a little sportier look to it, took it to a detail place, and they were going to put some pinstripes on it. And when they looked at his car, they said, you know, it's been repainted. And he said, no, this is a new car. And they said, let me show you. It's been repainted. And he was shocked. I mean, shocked that they would do such a thing. So he confronts BMW and says, I bought this as a, you know, you sold it to me as over a new car, and it turns out you repainted this thing. And BMW says, well, our policy is that if the repairs add up to less than 3% of the car's value, we still consider it a new car. So if we have to change something, or, you know, in this case, there was some damage in transport from acid rain, and so we just repainted it. Do you have a problem with that? He said, yes, I do. And he sued BMW, and when they went to calculate the compensatory award, he offered an expert who said that in selling this car, he would get $4,000 more for the car if it were really new, whereas if he tried to sell it and had to disclose that, in fact, it had been repainted, it would be worth $4,000 less than that. Seems a little high. I haven't been in the market for a BMW recently, but assuming I were, I think if somebody said, I've got these two identical BMWs, one of which has been repainted and the other one has not, I think something short of $4,000, I would take the one that had been repainted and put the difference in my pocket. But that's just me. It probably shows why I'm not in the market for a BMW. But the jury found that this estimate of $4,000 was accurate and then imposed a punitive award to teach BMW a lesson. Now, quite frankly, as between Dr. Gore and BMW, I'm having trouble generating moral outrage here. But again, maybe that's just me. The jury, however, was morally outraged and they essentially found out, how many of these things do you sell? Well, it turns out there are 1,000 cases like this. Well, fine. It's 1,000 times 4,000, that's 4 million. Alabama Supreme Court said, that's too much. 2 million is the most we could go on this. And BMW then appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is the first case, as I said before, in which the U.S. Supreme Court said, this is our business, over the protest of some dissenting justices. And you can't impose this, in part because you're, in effect, imposing law upon what happens in Iowa or Illinois or in Colorado. And who gives you, a jury in Alabama, the authority, in effect, to make nationwide law? After all, in some other places, what BMW did was perfectly legal. By statute, you can sell a car as new if it's if the repairs to the car are less than 3% of its value. So it seems anomalous, according to the Supreme Court, that a jury in Alabama could punish BMW for doing something that was legal in the place where they did it. It may be illegal in Alabama, but again, this extraterritorial reach. Plus the notion that if they, again, using this criterion of what civil or criminal sanctions were available. If the state of Alabama had gone after BMW, they couldn't have levied a $4 million fine for this conduct. So the Supreme Court said, disproportionate, redo. Take a mulligan on this one. Redo it. Okay, so the Supreme Court of Alabama, having found out that their reduction from $4 million to $2 million was not enough, starts to pick this thing apart. They go through all these criteria. They wind up saying the proper amount of punitive damages is $50,000. So Dr. Gore has gone from the point of getting $4 million. And again, when we look back, there's a little time differential here. But we look at Richard Grimshaw horribly burned in this auto accident, and he's getting, well, I guess he's getting $6 million. Mr. Gore has a repainted, or Dr. Gore, excuse me, has a repainted BMW, and he gets $4 million. There's, you know, something wrong with this picture. But when we get it back to $50,000, Dr. Gore is saying, in effect, my lawyers have spent that and then some. I wish I'd just, you know, taken my BMW and gone home. I've come out, in effect, worse at the end of the day than I was when I started. And it may be that the Alabama Supreme Court, in coming to that conclusion, is saying to the U.S. Supreme Court, in effect, if you want to run the railroad, this is the way we'll do it. Don't blame us if this seems like a crazy result. Blame the people that tell us what to do. So, again, it's a wild kind of ride here, and it, I would suggest, fuels the complaint of people like BMW or other corporations, whether it's Ford Motor Company or Kmart or Walmart or whoever it is that's being hit with punitive damages, to say this really looks a whole lot more like going to Las Vegas and spinning the roulette wheel than anything that could remotely be called a system of justice. And, how can we take these awards and make them something that looks more predictable? Now, I think the trial lawyer's response to the assertion of randomness is that, gee, there are a lot of things in life that are random. What matters, my likelihood of getting pulled over for speeding, or for that matter, the likelihood I'll get pulled over for a DUI, is pretty remote. Most of the time, I could go out there and be impaired and get home without anybody noticing it. Every once in a while, I get pulled over, and then really bad things happen. And the fact that it's sort of random doesn't mean it's a bad system. It means we sort of, every once in a while, find a bad guy, and then we beat him senseless. And in the end, that kind of keeps people on the straight and narrow. Anyway, yeah, last comment here. Absolutely. And lots of cases settle after trial, before appeal, because the parties don't want to take the risk of, and there's some midway point they can meet. Okay, we'll pick up with attorney's fees briefly tomorrow, but then move on to talk about wrongful death.